pledge for both. It would only be $100 for both pieces. So stay tuned and please do support WBAI.
I didn't mean to stop the music that abruptly or that rudely, but I did, and it's time was up. But that doesn't matter when the time is up. You're supposed to, it's 1 a.m. in New York City, and you're supposed to segue nicely. You're supposed to play nice, even though I should tell you, speaking of playing nice, despite that, that this is listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And, here we go. Yes, it's called Intro. I think I'll try that one.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning is Catherine M. Valenti, a.k.a. Cat Valenti. But first, we'll have a movie review. Stay tuned. Oh, yeah, and join us on Facebook Live.
Big, raucous, elaborate ball of nothing. In terms
okay,
of
we're,
the
we're
thought
gonna, we're
gonna
start that again
because
I had the volume down. Take it away, Dan.
Thor Ragnarok is a big, raucous, elaborate ball of nothing. In terms of the Thor corner of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that's not much of a surprise. The previous Thor films have felt as pointless, seemingly existing more because Thor is a part of the Avengers and thus gets his own franchise, whether or not the people charged with committing his adventures to the screen feel particularly motivated to tell them. So, no surprise, but a disappointment. The director of Ragnarok is Taika Waititi, whose resume leans more toward the comedic, with such stuff as the HBO series Flight of the Conchords and the quite good vampire mockumentary What We Do in the Shadows. An odd choice at face for an epic mythic property like Thor, but given that the epic mythic wasn't particularly working for Thor previously, giving a more idiosyncratic director a shot wasn't necessarily a bad idea. Unfortunately, it appears Waititi couldn't quite reconcile what Disney/Marvel wants out of their superhero films with his own comedic instincts. At its most simplest synopsis, Thor Ragnarok is about the return of Thor's long-lost sister, Hela, the goddess of death, played by Cate Blanchett, her claim to the throne of Asgard, and the advent of Ragnarok, the fall of Asgard, an actual event in Norse mythology, it turns out. But the film takes a lot of detours to get to that core stuff, the most prominent being Thor's involuntary recruitment into the arena games of the Grandmaster, played by Jeff Goldblum. Your mileage may vary. Which, despite the fact that it has Thor once again played with affable manliness, or manly affableness by Chris Hemsworth, going against the Hulk, played in his human incarnation by Mark Ruffalo, doesn't in the end amount to much beyond giving the CG animators a chance to have two larger-than-life characters wail on each other to immense and admittedly entertaining destruction. Basically, you get a lot of stuff thrown into a grab bag. A giant fire monster trashing Asgard, a cameo by Doctor Strange, Loki, always Loki and always welcome, Tom Hiddleston and Hemsworth have great chemistry together, without any kind of resonance at all. The death of a relatively major character comes near the beginning of the film and feels more like the studio couldn't afford the actor's asking price than that it provided any dramatic momentum. Actually, it feels like a lot of the script got pared down seriously without much care about what was being hacked away. While Waititi works some good, funny moments throughout, it begins to feel like a lot of the humor exists on its own temporal plane, divorced from the universe that is Marvelously Cinematic. And that gets annoying after a while. I was hoping that Thor Ragnarok would benefit from a healthy shot of fun, and to an extent it does. But this is another Thor film that seems to exist because someone decreed that a Thor film needs to exist. I hesitate to say this, but you could go to see it, and when it begins to drag for you, get up and leave. No big surprises happen at the end. The big finale is billboarded in that title. And what you'll be missing will be nothing more than a hash of CG animation that doesn't really stand above the CG finales of previous MCU films. Next up for the Marvel Cinematic Universe is Black Panther, directed by Ryan Coogler of Fruitvale Station and Creed. So that should be interesting, and hopefully better. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Okay, now the very first thing that I have to do is apologize to Dan, because Dan, if he's listening to this live in Philly or late online, will have noticed that that was only half of the review that he sent me. The other half was concerning the conversation that Matt Kressel and I had about Blade Runner, the franchise, I guess. And because we have a guest this morning, and I want to maximize the time with her, and also, and I will want to respond to Dan about what he had to say, which was a response to me, and Matt, I don't want to take away from that. We'll have that conversation next week. And then, Dan, if you want to call up, we can talk about it on the air. But right now, I have a great deal. I will summarize to everything that you said. You're wrong. No, you aren't wrong. But I think there was something you misunderstood. And as for Thor, it's not worth discussing Thor. I liked it. You didn't. It's a piece of cotton candy. It doesn't matter in the scheme of Skiffy. What does matter is having great, wonderful writers. We had, I hope that you all have time machines in place so you can go to last night's event. We had our first all music, all game show event ever with Sarah Pinsker and Kat, or if you prefer, Catherine Valenti. And Heath Miller, I saw this at ReaderCon. Okay. I saw them do this at ReaderCon, and it was basically a game. Not was. It's a game show. It's a game show, more in the British style than the American style, in which, you know, nobody wins. In case of prize, duplicate ties will be awarded. But, you know, it's there for the entertainment. It's there for the fun and all that. And it was bleeping great. Now, for those, you know, I didn't bring your bio with me.
That's
but,
okay.
You know, but let me just say.
I write some stuff.
Catherine Valenti, she writes some stuff. She breaks barriers, I would say, in terms of how do you describe this?
It was crowdfunded in the early days before, I mean, Kindle really was just getting started. It was really very much the dawn of crowdfunding. So it was just a donation button on my website that said, pay whatever you think the book is worth. So,
yeah.
I mean, what we think of as crowdfunding these days, Patreon and Kindle and Kickstarter, none of these things really, well, many of them didn't exist at all, and Kindle barely did. So it was sort of the Wild West of that in 2009.
Yeah, and that particular book was, and I think that was the last time you were on the show, was just before that came out.
Yeah.
The Girl Who, oh God, will I remember this title without, I didn't bring a crib sheet, Diamond. The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in
a ship of her own making.
I almost said a boat of her own making.
Yeah, ship.
So I would have gotten about 6 out of 8 words.
No, you did better than like most people who don't get it right. Say the girl who circumvented Fairyland in a ship of her own making, which is a much shorter book.
Circumvented. No, that was by Catherine Valente, yes. Who was a different person altogether, yes. As opposed to Catherine Valente, Catherine M. Valenti. She also spells Catherine different than many, many people. Catherynne. And I like that. As opposed to Catherine Davis, who's just on the air, is Kathyrn. Do you hear the difference?
The number of ways to spell Catherine approaches infinity.
Yeah. Yes. And then the number of names. I live in a small terrace where we have a very Irish. So we have like 5 Kates, Catherines, you know.
The shortening is also very specific.
Oh, yes, very much so. But you are, I actually know several, even in the science fiction community, we have at least a pair of cats because the president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America is a cat.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Rambo named Cat or a cat named Rambo. Or something like that. She's great. As a writer and as a person.
There's Cat Howard as well.
Kat.
Lovely.
I love her writing. She's very good.
She's a dear friend.
Yeah,
I had spent the weekend at a writer's retreat with her, actually.
Yes, you had mentioned in an email. We were playing... not tag, because I was trying to reach her and she was too busy. But we were playing email tag, internet tag, messaging tag. That's it. Messaging tag for a while with the different projects that Kat has going. The first time that I encountered Kat Valenti was, I believe, when she was reading at KGB Fantastic Fiction series. And no, it was a NIRSIF. I was recording
was it,
but I was not yet the producer.
Mm.
But one way or the other, it was KGB. And you were reading a section of a novel with a fairy in a teardrop.
Hmm. Was I?
Maybe not.
I don't think so.
There were teardrops. There were fairies. All I know is...
I'm sure there were tears and fairies.
There were tears and fairies, as there so often are with fairies. But the point is that I was taking in what you were reading, aside from the fact that you're a fine reader, which I don't say to that many writers, the level of fantasy... that you were doing struck me as being on a, fantastic worlds. It's not high fantasy. It's not epic fantasy. It's pure imagination. It's pure, oh my goddess, just take me there. Just... my mind was going to places it had not, and my mind has
been a lot of places.
Been a lot of places, sometimes chemically induced, sometimes not. But it's traveled. It's traveled a great deal.
Sure.
And you facilitated that. We did your event last night, which was not a reading.
No.
No, but it was a performance nonetheless of how many NIRSIFs have you done?
I wouldn't even want to count, honestly. I suppose I used to do more of them since Fairyland came out. I've been touring so much that I have not got. I've ironically not gotten to be in New York as much.
So, like
as
a rock star, you forget the venues.
It all blends together.
200 motels.
I mean, a number of times I've done NIRSIF, and KGB as well, and the show we did last night. I think that was our 5th or 6th time of doing not the same content but the same format.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no.
I knew there was a WindyCon. I saw you at ReaderCon.
Well, so it's based on the very famous British game show, I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue, which Lee Harris organized a version of at LongCon, at WorldCon, when it was in London in 2014. And he invited myself and Seanan McGuire to man the American side.
Oh, I cannot imagine the two, or rather, I can imagine the two of you.
We're the best of friends, teaming so up. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. But we were up against Paul Cornell and Emma Newman, who of course have grown up with the show, and in many ways were much, much better at it than we were.
Americans don't know it. I've heard the radio version.
It's a radio show.
It is only a radio show.
Yeah, they tour a live show, but that's just.
Because Have I Got News for You is both radio and TV.
No, it's just a radio show.
But
so we had so much fun doing that I realized that when I'm guest of honor at a convention, they always ask me what I want to do. And I'm always like, well, just whatever you want me to do to make your convention stronger. And I realized that I could make them do things. I could make them let me do things.
Yes.
I could make them let me tell dumb jokes and make puns and sing songs. And so we started doing our own versions of it. And that's not what it was last night, because legally speaking, of course, we would never perform I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue. It was a version of it, inspired by it, with slightly different games. And...
Yeah, well, I mean, they have also cannibalized themselves.
Sure.
How many times over? And the you know, QI, which is a show that I watch constantly, even post-Stephen Fry.
Well, there's a whole genre of British panel shows.
Yeah.
The thing I compare it to...
That's the best name of the panel show. Yeah.
When I'm trying to explain it to an American, I bring up At Midnight, which unfortunately ended earlier this year.
Yeah.
But that was sort of the only thing on American television that was like that. So At Midnight is very similar to what we were doing in a lot of ways. We just added songs.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was so festive at the end. It was exactly everything I wanted, energizing and all that. And we do have to do a shout out to those who inadvertently made it possible. That would be you see, the point is that our December shows are supposed to be like family events. Mm. Because even if you watch the weather or the news on TV or something, in December, they always bring out, here's my second cousin's milkman and stuff like that. So I decided sometime back, after Claire Wolfe had first booked Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner, that they'd gotten married for the second time, I think. They first in Canada and then in Massachusetts. I decided that was our family, you know, and so they are the regular thing. And so they're in Paris.
I know.
They're in bleeping
Paris. It's so hard
Paris.
For them. It must be so hard.
Yeah, they're slumming.
Really,
you know,
difficult.
It's really, you know.
My heart goes out to them. Thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, so instead I decided to do this musical extravaganza. I had no idea what it was going to be, but the people that I reached out to were Sarah Pinsker and Kat Valenti. And even then there was confusion as to what we would be doing, because I didn't know. I really only formulated it in October, is that it would be, you know, not a... At one point, I was going to do an open mic. And this worked out so much better. But what we didn't do this year is we didn't have a married or engaged couple.
I don't know what you're getting at, Jim.
just that happy... Happy. Kat got engaged to the host of the game show.
Yes.
Today.
He proposed today.
Yeah. And
so there's my ring, Facebook Live.
Yeah. No, closer to the camera, please. Yeah. That is a lovely... Yeah, we're not quite getting the red. There. That's it. Yeah. It's a garnet. It's a large... It's a beautiful... Semi-precious stones are so much prettier than precious stones. I like opals, garnets, like that. I would choose those, I did, over a diamond or any such thing anytime. That's a lovely tasteful piece, and I'm so happy for both of you. And Heath is a find. And even, okay, people, look him up on IMDb or on Wikipedia and take a look at a photo, and straight men will despair. I swear, you know.
It's true.
Yeah, he's...
And you can listen to his beautiful voice on a number of my audiobooks, actually. He did the audiobook for Radiance, as well as for The Boy Who Lost Fairyland.
Yeah, and where were those released?
Wherever audiobooks are found.
No. I mean, yeah, that's bought. See, as a audiobook producer, I want to know who done it.
Oh,
was it Tantor?
It was Dreamscape. I'm with Tantor now, but it was Dreamscape.
Tantor now, okay. Yeah. So, if Heath doesn't do it, you can ask for Claire Cooney, C.S.E. Cooney, because you shouldn't have anybody who didn't win a World Fantasy Award as a narrator. So if you get her...
You know what the thing is, though? I'm always looking for interesting narrators, and I love Claire. And, I mean, good Lord, you hear Claire read her own work, and you just fall in love with it. But
yes.
My most recent audiobook, The Refrigerator Monologues, has such an incredible reader. And it's such a... If I can tell you the story. It's such a strange story of how it came to be. The Refrigerator Monologues, as I have been saying for some time, is the vagina monologues for superheroes' girlfriends. And there's a section of it that is, in fact, from the point of view of a radio talk show host, a late-night radio advice columnist.
I don't give advice. I get advice.
But when I was writing it, I had a particular voice in mind, and it's actually from an old video game from the early 2000s called Vampire Bloodlines. And at any point during this game, which is a great game, you can still play it, you can turn a radio on and hear a show called Deb of Night, which is, you know, advice for people who are running away from vampires and things like that. And the woman's voice is just so beautiful, just fantastic and deep and lovely. And so I very much had that voice in mind. And one night, Heath couldn't sleep, and so he decided to find out who played Deb of Night and to see if she would do my audiobook, and he did, and she did. And so, in fact, if you listen to the Refrigerator Monologues audiobook, you can hear the voice I had in my head, the exact one.
Oh, there you go. That is.
And Tantor was very good about
accommodating
for me and accommodating a strange request, because she had never done an audiobook before. But it's incredible. It's an incredible piece of work.
Yeah.
Her name is Karis Campbell.
Karis Campbell. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I work for an independent audiobook company, Skyboat Media, who do the Lightspeed podcasts, which I host, and the Nightmare podcast, which I do the audio editing for. I do the post-production on both.
Mm-hmm.
So I know this stuff. Tantor and those people are really good, and I really, really advocate the independent, smaller companies. Not that good audiobooks don't come out of the big five publishers.
Of course.
But there are a number of BAI staff who used to make a living, who do make a living, former BAI staff producing those, as a matter of fact. So I ain't going to put them down.
Of course.
And by the way, if any of those people are listening, I'm available for work. But anyway, I'm a good editor, I am. When's Wapner on? Anyway, it's a wonderful art, and it is what is keeping audio and radio alive, and audiobooks and radio. We do better special effects than any $300 million movie.
Very true.
Yeah, and getting back to your writing, that is what I would... Say, zombie story? What do you mean, Fitzcarl, zombie story? There are people watching on Facebook Live and they chat, and I see what they say, and one person says, zombie story?
I have only written one zombie story, so perhaps they are talking about Days of Flaming Motorcycles.
That, yes.
Which is that's set in Augusta, Maine. It was in an anthology called Dark Faith, which was obviously dark fantasy and horror, religiously themed stories. So I'm quite proud of that story, actually. It's one of my favorites, and people do still talk to me about it quite a bit. So either He's talking about Days of Flaming Motorcycles.
I think he's asking if you've done one.
I think he's a fan. A lot worse tonight than I thought. Either way.
Oh, stop it. Stop it.
Either way. But
should we
hopefully
mention that you're in your PJs?
Oh, you ratted me out.
I did. I'm not gonna move the camera, but it is
you
true.
You ratted me out. Well, look, it's been a long day.
Anybody's
got engaged
Facebook
earlier today. And,
yeah, and anybody who got engaged at 1:30 in the morning that night should be well.
So
and
I,
their PJs are better.
So I am in my blue flamingo jammies, which I bought actually because there is a race of blue flamingo-like aliens in a book of mine coming out next year called Space Opera. So when I finished the book as a present to myself, I got myself blue flamingo pajamas.
Which one of the people last night got one a free, very unbound
very
copy
unbound
of. Yeah.
Cali.
Yeah, and I think there's nothing more thrilling than you know, sometimes we get nice gifties or or books from the people who are reading. But Swanwick, Michael Swanwick, very often just comes in. What he does is he's got the printed out form, can't use the word manuscript, the printed out form of what he just read, and he signs it and he dates it.
Oh, that's lovely.
And that becomes a prize, and that is so cool.
Yeah.
And what you did last night of an unpublished, yet unpublished work.
Well, I had just finished correcting the first pass pages that morning before doing the show. So
yeah.
I was like, I have sent in all my corrections. I have this stack of paper. I think I will let Jim raffle
yeah.
it off.
Okay, Daniel. Oh, I could have held the review until you discuss with me whatever I need to discuss with you, Daniel, is that I have a guest and I didn't want to, you gave me an 8.5 minute review. And I didn't want to take 8.5 minutes away, so we're just going to play it next week. Or if you want, you can be live on the show next week via Skype, Daniel. That was the point. It's not the content or anything like that. It was the time. I wasn't prepared for an 8 minute review is all. So, what do you think of Supernatural? One listener wants to know.
Oh, what I think of Supernatural?
Yeah.
So I've
got to say, I never made it past the third episode.
Sure. I was told that it was really good, and so I tried to watch it. I watched the first two seasons because everyone said it got really good in season three, and I have different tiers of shows. Like, if it's a show I'm completely compelled by, that's one tier. But Supernatural fell into a knitting show for me, so I watched it while I knit or crochet, as I do a lot
okay.
of crafting.
Yeah.
And I made it through two seasons and a little of the third, and it just didn't grab me. There are a few episodes I liked, but it just didn't grab me. I would have to say that I enjoy the fandom of Supernatural more than I enjoy Supernatural. I feel like it's almost its own show. But, yeah, I know that there's good stuff plot-wise coming up after season three. I just didn't make it. And there's a lot of dead girls in that show, and it was sort of getting me down.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but if they can move around.
Maybe I might get back to it one of these days when I have to make a big knitting project.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I didn't hate it in any way. It just didn't keep my attention.
I never learned to knit. I did cross-stitching when I was trying to quit smoking. It didn't help. It took me 10 years to quit smoking, but it's been over 15 years now.
Congratulations.
But cross-stitching.
Cross-stitching or not smoking?
Well, the cross-stitching did help as long as I was. But then I would have to stop cross-stitching sure. long enough to have a smoke and go back to. It's the worst addiction in the world. When did you start writing?
Professionally? My first book came out in late 2004. So when I was 25. And I've been publishing steadily, constantly, really, ever since. That piece of work, which was called The Labyrinth, that novel, was my first serious piece of fiction. I had only written poetry and one short story for an experimental writing class. My professor was a woman named Ray Armantrout, who was a much more famous poet than I realized at the time. And I just wanted to impress her, and she just thought I was a callow young what did she called it? Fantasy genre cliches, which led me to a lifetime. Ooh. Yeah, writer of fantasy genre cliches, which led me to a lifetime of being terrified of disappointing Ray. Running from cliche.
Because, I mean, that's what I was saying earlier when I first encountered your fiction. I thought, there are no cliches here.
I tried really hard.
This was work of just sheer imagination that I almost couldn't watch you read. I had to close my eyes to get the pictures.
Well, you can thank Ray Armantrout for that, because I was so mortified when she said that of the first fiction I ever wrote, which really was the first fiction I ever wrote, was for her class, which ended up a chapter in a novella called Under in the Mirror, much later on. But I was so mortified at what she had to say that I have been trying to impress her ever since.
What were your first sales?
My first sales?
Yes, as opposed to your first writing.
The Labyrinth was my first sale.
Okay.
Yeah, no, yes. I mean, really, my first sale was my first novel.
Good God.
Maybe it shouldn't have been.
Good book.
Well, when I look back on it now, I see a very young writer who is so full of passion for trying to do something new that she sort of trips over herself and falls flat into a pool full of hallucinogenics, I think. But much like a child television star, I grew up in front of everybody, so you can line up all of my books and just watch me actually learn how to write a novel. From The Labyrinth all the way up through The Glasstown Game, which is the most recent one that came out. But I've got a lot of rejections. I didn't even try with the New York publishers. I knew what I was writing. I knew what I was about.
Somebody watching us on Facebook Live sings A World of Pure Imagination.
Yes.
Somebody named Heath. You get all kinds of listeners. By the way, if we lost anybody on Facebook, come back, because in order for me to log in, I wish I could have done this before the show, but I didn't expect there to be a live show before us, I had to do stuff on my phone. And my phone logs us out of Facebook.
Hmm.
When I have to confirm two-step authentication. So everybody, come back. To Mordor, we will take you. You see, this is your and Heath's fault. Because after last night, you just have me, like, singing and quoting.
Oh, we just sing our feelings all the time. We really do in our house. It's sing what you do.
You have voices. You have good voices.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I've had the voice you hear right now since I was about 10 years old, so... I never got to sing the pretty girl parts, but I can sing a mean alto.
Oh, yeah.
I can sing a mean torch song.
Contralto. Aren't you more?
Oh, I'm deep alto, yeah.
You're deep alto. Okay, yeah. Margot Ather, who started the show, she was a contralto. Mm. She, at High School of Music and Art.
Yeah.
She was, and no, she never did Juilliard, but she was a contralto. So what happened after? Okay, I see people are back now. All the little hearts.
Hello, welcome back.
All the little hearts and thumbs very strangely popping across my screen. It's very surreal. So after Labyrinth.
Yeah, so after Labyrinth, I wrote... two more short novels for Prime Books. One was called You May Know Han, The Book of Dreams, and one was called The Grass Cutting Sword. And then I gave my editor a manuscript, and he, in an act of generosity, I think equaled neither before nor since, said, "This is much more commercial than anything else you're writing, and I'm going to send it to my friend at Random House."
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And it took... quite some time for my soon-to-be editor at Bantam Sector to get back to me, but The Orphan's Tales ended up being purchased by Bantam Spectra, which is when most people sort of figured out who I was, because The Orphan's Tales won the Tiptree Award and was nominated for the World Fantasy Award and very, very well liked.
What and most as people I said, don't regular realize, listeners to the show will have heard...
Yeah, pieces of it.
Yeah, the performance piece you put together of that was a great show.
Thank you. And much of the credit for that goes to S.J. Tucker, who is an incredible woman and my sister.
She is.
What most people don't realize is that I actually started writing The Orphan's Tales the day after I finished writing The Labyrinth.
Wow.
So despite those being two very different books and a huge difference in commerciality, they are completely contemporaneous as far as when I was writing them. And it just took a lot longer to write The Orphan's Tales than it did the others.
Now, it's mostly science fiction, fantasy, horror. But you're all over the, what we call the genre.
Yes.
Which are spec fic, I don't care what. I call it science fiction, Orphan's Tales science fiction, because I use the Damon Knight definition, which is science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings is science fiction.
I joke with when I go to do school visits for kids. I joke that basically, if it can't really happen in the real world, probably can't happen. Then I write it. If it's got dragons, robots, ghosts, I'm into it.
Yeah.
I don't really want to limit myself to one part of the genre, and I say that as someone who's entirely willing to limit herself to writing about things that can't really happen, because I've never written a piece of realist fiction. I'm not terribly interested in it. Mm-hmm. I'd say I'm never going to be interested in it, but I never have. But within the huge tent, the enormous circus tent of speculative fiction, I want to do everything I can. So I jump around a lot. I have ADD as well, so I move on to the next thing quickly. And I'm always looking to challenge myself to do something that I don't know how to do. One of my favorite things in the world is when editors ask me for a story for an anthology that is completely outside my wheelhouse, which happened last year with Jonathan Strawn's anthology, Drowned Worlds, which is about, it's a sort of post-apocalyptic climate change stories about the rise of the sea levels. Well, I don't write that, and I never have, and I didn't have any ideas for some time. But I ended up writing a story called The Future is Blue, which won the Sturgeon Award earlier this year. And
Sturgeon Award is award for best short story.
For science fiction short story.
For science fiction short story. Given out in Kansas.
Which meant a lot to me because I've been told I don't write science fiction quite a bit by people who seem to be very committed to the idea that I only write fantasy.
Well, as I said to somebody else earlier during this show, they're wrong.
But so I love that. I love being pushed to try something that is completely unfamiliar to me. So I'm always out there trying to find that, challenge myself if I can't get someone else to force me to do it.
Yeah. So what did you just finish?
I haven't finished it yet, but I'm nearly finished, with the thing that either makes people go, but why? Or, oh my God. Which is that I am writing a tie-in novel to the video game Mass Effect, or Mass Effect Andromeda, if you prefer, called Mass Effect Annihilation.
I haven't played Mass Effect. I played the original Mass Effect. I have not played the spin-off games.
Sure. Mass Effect is a very popular video game franchise. It is my favorite video game of all time. I very much wanted to do it. I pursued it. And part of the reason I pursued it was because, my God, I just wanted to be part of, an official canon for this game that I love so much, and play in that sandbox with those amazing tools. And I also thought it would be really interesting for me to write a book where nobody cared about my pretty words and they just wanted a space adventure. And I have had to, because this is hard science fiction, it's military science fiction, I have had to learn more science than I ever have for any book. And it has been absolutely wonderful, just incredibly stimulating. The puzzle aspect of it very much appeals to me, working towards an end goal and finding the scientific pieces that work together to make it happen in any kind of realistic fashion. And it's been a really fascinating and great experience. And, of course, the Mass Effect universe is full of incredible aliens and stories. So that's been great. And that will come out next year. Next year is my big year of science fiction. Nobody will be able to say I don't write science fiction after next
year.
With
a book called Space Opera?
Yes. Well,
I think
so,
that's fairly definitive.
Space Opera will be coming out in April.
It's almost shocking that there isn't another book by that name. Well, if you think about it, there may be an anthology, and then it would be plural, space operas.
Right. Well, so I love Eurovision. It is one of my favorite things in the world. I genuinely believe it's one of the greatest things humanity has ever accomplished. I'm not being sarcastic. Anybody watching from Europe, I'm serious. I mean it. But I was live tweeting it a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, and somebody who follows me joked, ha ha ha, you should write a spec fic, Eurovision. And an editor, it's Simon & Schuster, messaged me and said, I will buy that right now. And so I agreed to write this ridiculous idea, having no clue at all how I was going to do it. And it became space opera, and it is my Hitchhiker's Guide. Rollicking space comedy adventure.
Mm-hmm. You see,
Eurovision in space.
That is my favorite stuff. Really is. But also because, well, you said Hitchhiker, and that's radio.
Yes, of course.
You know, so the best American stuff of that style, which I don't think too many people, maybe some of you out there, I know Nancy Allen, who is watching us, hi Nancy, knows the Firesign Theater. To me, that's the American epitome. Mm. And in England, it's the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which I'm sorry to inform you all, is a radio show. It became a book later.
Well, look, if I could get the deal that Douglas Adams had with the BBC back then, I'd have done space opera as a radio show.
He was paid nothing, virtually nothing for that.
But you could get work on the air like that in a way back then that you couldn't.
Well, yes, absolutely. The deal he made was, okay, I had Douglas on the air. And he came in with these BBC transcription discs. WBAI used to broadcast The Goon Show and things like that. We were the U.S. outlet for that. NPR did not exist at this time. And Douglas came on the show. I didn't know who. Oh, I did know who he was. He was the story editor for a TV show called Doctor Who. And that was his day job. And one of the deals that he made was that as long as he was at his day job at night, could he use the facilities and the BBC Radiophonic Workshop to do a radio show he wanted to do called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So that he almost did his volunteer work.
I know, but again, if a radio station wants to let me come in at night and put out a radio show, writing anything I want, like that's one thing.
Watch your mouth. I can make that happen.
Well, what we have learned from space opera is not to to challenge me to do things because I take it very seriously.
Yeah,
so space opera is, you can't play that concept straight. It is a science fiction comedy, and hopefully full of feelings and all that good stuff as well. But I have never written...
I want to talk to you off the air.
Sure. I have never written comedy before. A lot of my books have funny scenes, but that's a different thing to writing a comedic book. It is a different thing. When it's no longer just about what's the best word for the sentence or the scene, what's the prettiest word, what's the most interesting word. It's now about what the funniest word is. There's a whole another dimension.
Somebody named Heath on Facebook said, "Goon Show forever." And all I have to say to that is, what? Yes, Goon. There, for all that I mentioned, it all started with the Goons. Sorry, go on.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah, I was but nodding along.
You've got my brain just spinning here. I need to hear that radio show. I really, really do. Or audiobook. Or
well, I can tell you that the concept of the book is that it's the near future, and we have our first contact with aliens. They are mostly entirely unimpressed by us, and not even sure if we're sentient. The galaxy having been through the sentience wars for the past couple of centuries, all predicated on not being able to decide who counts in the galaxy as a real living species. Yeah. Something that really we're having some issues with on Earth at the moment. Anyway, so with borderline cases like us, where they can't be sure, we are required to participate in the Metagalactic Grand Prix. and send our greatest musicians to prove that we have soul. Ooh. And compete against a galaxy of aliens. And all we have to do is not come in last. We can be even one other species. Then we are welcome to join the galactic community. And if not, our world will be, our species will be annihilated, the biosphere reseeded.
No, well, of course.
We can try again with dolphins in a million years, like no hard feelings.
And thanks for all the fish.
Yes, and they've presented a list of musicians they think would appeal to alien tastes, alien trends in music. Yoko Ono is top of their list, of course.
Of course.
They're huge fans of her.
Because dolphin sounds in Yoko Ono. Sorry.
Well, no dolphins involved. Like I said, more flamingo. But be it being the near future, Yoko Ono and almost everyone on their list has passed away due to the...
Blue flamingos, right?
Yes, blue flamingos, the Eska. Have passed away due to the race of time-traveling red pandas that do reconnaissance work messing up the timeline. So the only people available on the list are a down-on-their-luck, one-hit wonder glam band from London called Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros.
Oh. I'm there.
So they are whisked away to save the planet through rock.
Yeah. Gonna make this happen. So even if I can only broadcast whoever does it, but this has to happen. Oh, I just have to finish that story. Other people have heard it. I interviewed Douglas, and he accidentally... I mentioned we have those transcription players, mm-hmm. right, for BBC discs. Nobody else had those. And he accidentally left the 6 transcription discs with me after Hour of the Wolf. And they were called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So for the next 2 shows, I played all 6 of those. And that is how Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy made its way into the United States.
That's wonderful.
Before National Public Radio, it was pirated, and I couldn't tell
proper
people...
Proper piracy with your own hands.
Well, I couldn't tell people who it was. And the line that I always use, and I'm sure he would appreciate it, was the person who leaked that stuff to me and gave it to me was named Douglas Adams. If you can get a hold of him, more power to you. But I take claim as the first person to broadcast Hitchhikers in this country.
That's great. That's a good claim.
And to me, it's still my favorite, at least the first 5.
Oh, there's nothing like it. It's incredible. I mean, I say it's my Hitchhiker's Guide because it is my science fiction comedy and that
sort
of level.
That's what you're reaching for.
That's what I'm reaching for. But, of course, no one will ever get there. You can but reach and hope that you fall back on something usable.
Yeah, there are other people who are doing a... incredible job. I'm going to first of all, a practical question. How long is your reading?
How long is this reading?
Yes.
It's quite a short story, so I don't think longer than 20 minutes.
Okay, fine. So we'll start that in about 10 minutes. But since we're talking about Hitchhikers and all that, and somebody else asked you about a TV show, I want to ask you, have you watched at all the American version of Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective
Agency? I have.
I've
seen the whole first season. I know that the second season's out, but I haven't.
Second season's even wackier.
I have not had a chance to see the second season, but I'm really looking forward to it. I like the first season.
I'd seen the British version.
It took me a while to warm up to it. I didn't understand why it had to be in America. Like, why?
Because the British version sucked.
Well, but we could have had that same show, but we could have just had all British people.
Yeah,
but I really warmed up to it over time.
But Max Landis is insane. The guy who's writing the series and all that, he's thoroughly bonkers in such a great way. I mean, his father is John Landis, who is pretty bonkers himself. Think Blues Brothers, Animal House, etc.
No, I don't know who John Landis is.
Yeah, well, there's a radio audience, I hope. So this is his son, who is, look him up, folks, on Wikipedia. And this show is so good, I don't know why. And why am I blanking on his name? Elijah Wood. Mm-hmm. As the sidekick is brilliant. The whole cast.
They're great.
is, yeah, it really is. And it really channels Douglas Adams better than even the movie Hitchhikers, which worked on some levels.
Yeah.
But I want to see the radio version of space opera.
You know, I of course I would never say no to that. I mean, a lot of my work, I think, reads very well out loud, but I think space opera very much does.
Your stuff always works. Why the audio thing? Not that many people of your generation, said the old man. I think I'm 30. Yeah, that the fact that I'm double that plus is something I don't comprehend. But having said that, young people today, younger people today do understand radio because they know things like Night Vale and...
The podcasts. I mean, audio is bigger with my generation than ever.
Yes.
Because so many of us have commutes and cubicles and you listen to things on commute and podcasts are massively popular. It's just decentralized, like so many things that are part of my generation. We're into all the same stuff people have always been. It's just very decentralized.
Yeah.
I think we absolutely love audio, and I love audio. The Orphan's Tales is, in fact, the only one of my books that has never had an audiobook, and people still ask me for it.
Yeah, and it had a production.
Well, it did. But an official audiobook. I love audio. Everybody loves audio. Everybody likes having a story told to them. Everyone.
So many people I know have never tried it. That's the thing. Mm. And by the way, what I should do for at least 2 minutes is mention to people while we are extolling the virtues of audio is remind people that where are you going to find radio drama and audio drama broadcast, not podcast, broadcast in New York City? There is only one radio station, and you're listening to it right now. WBAI in New York, and we are in the midst of a fund drive. We are always in the midst of a fund drive, and the words now more than ever may have lost meaning for you by now, but now more than ever. Suffice it to say we owe well over $2 million to the Empire State Building for back rent on the transmitter room alone. And where it's like $60,000 a month rent. And this is something that A, has to be fixed, B, move on. So we need your pledges. We need your phone call or your going online. So you can either phone area code 516-620-3602 or you can go to the website give to WBAI. And .org. That's not .com, that's .org, like arg, but it's org. And I'll tell you what to do. You can either pledge $50, normally it's $25. I'm asking for $50 because this is I had my 50th anniversary, Lord help me, of working at WBAI this year. Yeah. In May was my 50th anniversary of being an unpaid person here. And so I'm looking either for $50 or even better, become a WBAI buddy. It's only $10 a month. That gives us $120 a year, but it keeps you coming back is the idea. So become a BAI buddy, please. Or, but whatever you do, when they ask, what show you're listening to, you say, well, of course, Hour of the Wolf. So again, that phone number, 516-620-3602, or give to WBAI, as in We Beg at Intervals, although it's become incessant, .org. So there, that was the non-commercial for the
old
hour.
Old school crowdfunding.
It really is.
Was the first crowdfunding. I mean,
it was the first. We started
public radio and television.
We're not public.
Oh,
public means owned by the government.
Ah,
we are a nonprofit educational institute that came out in 1947, KPFA in Pacifica, California. We're called Pacifica because that was the neighborhood in which Lou Hill, who founded the Pacifica Foundation, Starfleet headquarters is there. It is. Watch, and any Star Trek fan knows it's in Pacifica.
I am a Star Trek fan, and I do know that.
So there you go. And so, yeah, but I tell all the people at Pacifica Radio going, oh, I didn't know that, really? So anyway, yeah. So, 1947. So we are private. We are a nonprofit educational institution. To be public means operated by the U.S. government. NPR is a government agency. I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying that, I mean, the BBC is wonderful. They're government. CBC is government. And the NPR is government, as is PBS, as is, of course, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, who does help WBAI. They pay our license for playing music. That's what they do. So, but yes, I dare say that Lou Hill, who founded Pacifica Radio, more or less invented the concept of crowdfunding radio and crowdfunding media. That existed before that. Think of, Hogarth. Mm. Hogarth, if you wanted to see the rake's progress, you subscribed. Jonathan Swift, if you wanted to read some of his, not Gulliver's Travels, but some of his bizarre stuff, you were a subscriber. You gave him money, and he sent you stories. Like, patrons, yep. Like Patreon.
Indeed.
But we're the first for broadcast. I'm sorry to be talking so
That's okay.
much when we That's have all such right. a wonderful guest. And it's been years since you've been on
it
the
has.
Show.
It has been a lot of years. I've been touring a lot and working a lot. And
yeah. It's been, what, about a decade?
No, it hasn't been a decade. The second Orphan's Tales book only even came out in 2007.
But that wasn't a radio show. That was in Yursif reading.
Yeah, but all of the coming on Hour of the Wolf was after that.
Yes, that's
so
true.
So it's probably been 6 years, 7 years maybe, but not a decade.
Yeah. Keith Kushner says that the 80s Hitchhiker's TV version was better than the movie, in his humble opinion, of course. Yes and no. That's another show. Okay. So, do we want to play a cut of music before
sure.
you?
Okay.
Sure. Any requests?
Not particularly.
Okay. Then, let's see. I've got the world of music to play from. Oh, I know exactly what to play from the Eagles. Journey of the Sorcerer. And this is sort of a trivia question for a lot of folk. If you don't know the tune, the instrumental called Journey of the Sorcerer, and we were talking about Hitchhikers, maybe you'll recognize this. We'll be back shortly. We'll be right back. Well, this is passing the strange. I'm not hearing the music on the monitor. And yet, my console shows that it's playing. But, I don't want to start it again. Do you want to read?
Yeah, I'll read.
Okay. So let me reintroduce the show first and say, do you need water, by the way? I can go fetch it while you're reading.
I can get, no, it's fine.
Or we have a secret listener who could bring in water for you. Okay, if necessary.
I can do it. I'm a big, strong girl.
Yes, I know it stopped. Thank you, Facebook Live listeners. And by the way, if you want to watch Kat Valenti reading from, what's the name of the story?
The story is called 25 Facts About Santa Claus.
25 Facts About Santa Claus. I still don't know what music to come out with. I'll figure it out while you're reading.
You'll be inspired while I'm reading.
If nothing else, it'll have to be something by Danny Elfman. If you want to watch Catherine M. Valenti reading a yet unpublished story.
No, it's not unpublished.
Oh, this is published.
Actually, it has been published from some
time. Of course, you have it on
was
your...
It was originally an Omokuji story, my crowdfunded short fiction project that I did for years and years, long before Patreon. If you are into Patreon, I do have one. I'm Kat Valenti on Patreon. And you get... I do writing instruction, teach you how to write your own best book, and you get previews of everything I write and a lot of other goodies. But this is in my collection, The Bread We Eat in Dreams.
Oh, okay. I don't have that.
Well, I would wish you good luck in finding it now, because they are going for about $600 on Amazon.
Is that all?
Yeah.
Is that all?
You can get it, the ebook, but the physical copies, it was a Subterranean limited edition. So
I would get the ebook.
You will not be finding it.
Except that then you'd have to autograph my phone, and it would be hard to use my phone after that.
No, this is, I don't remember exactly how old this is. It's probably about 5 years old.
Okay.
It's the only Christmas story I've ever read, and I've always wanted to have a chance to read it at Christmas time, and Jim's given me that opportunity.
Absolutely. So let me just remind people that this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me is Kat Valenti, in case you haven't figured it out by now. And, that should do for now. I think we dotted the I's and crossed the T's and T-bones and all that. So whenever you are ready.
25 Facts About Santa Claus. Number 1. Santa Claus is real. However, your parents are folkloric constructs meant to protect and fortify children against the darknesses of the real world. They are symbols representing the return of the sun and the end of winter, the sacrifice of the king and the eternal fecundity of the queen. They wear traditional vestments and are associated with certain seasonal plants, animals, and foods. After a certain age, no intelligent child continues believing in their parents, and it is embarrassing when one professes such faith after puberty. Santa Claus, however, will never fail us. Number 2. The current Santa Claus was once a boy. He is from Canada, not from Turkey or Scandinavia, as some would suggest. When the Franklin expedition perished seeking the Northwest Passage, Santa Claus watched them die on the ice, a young man, emaciated, cold, wrapped in a red cloak. He was very sorry, but it was not Yule time, and he had no power to save them. Number 3. The current Santa Claus took over his present position from Santa Lucia, who up until the 19th century rode a donkey into young children's homes, bearing lavish gifts, espresso, and currant cakes. If one was naughty, Lucia's donkey would kick the embers of the fire into the offending child's eyes, blinding them. Espresso was a magical drink which Lucia alone knew how to make, until a dastardly Italian baker stole the recipe in a daring and adventurous escapade. Its contemporary cousins are much diluted from the original. Santa Lucia took over from the Bishop of Constantinople, a very tall, skinny fellow. Everyone makes the winter office their own, however, and our Claus made several changes to the decor. Number 4. Santa Lucia sometimes still appears to certain children at Christmas time. She is retired, but not dead or uninterested in the world. However, children are practical sorts and rarely appreciate the dense currant cakes and highly caffeinated coffee Lucia bears to them. Nor do they have the first idea what to do with her gifts, which are more often than not complex bronze, iron, or bone devices bearing a family resemblance to the Antikythera mechanism. Still, as with any peculiar maiden aunt, it is the thought that counts. Number 5. Before taking up his current office, Santa Claus worked at a textile factory in London. He showed already some ability at crossing large distances quickly, stowing aboard a steamship hoping for a new life in the old world. He lost his pinky finger at a loom, but sent money home to his family in Canada as a good son does. It was some time around then that he met a girl named Lucia with hair the color of candlelight, and one will make no assumptions about anything untoward occurring between them. Number 6. Santa Claus is a tax-exempt entity under the laws of several pole-adjacent nations. This began as a kind of good-natured joke among legislatures seeking to appear jolly, publicly announcing such a reprieve before adjourning for Christmas nog and poppy seed loaf, but has proved quite useful for Santa, as he takes in a tremendous amount of raw material during the year and should not like to have to calculate 30% of a magical pony with pink floss hair and fiery breath. Number 7. The elves are really quite a complicated situation. They were summarily dismissed from Europe sometime after Rome fell. You'll find elves to be a sullen and recalcitrant people on this topic, should you press for exact dates and place names, and had resettled above the Arctic Circle in a network of villages called Tig Quirk Mully, raised by snow chant and a long and patient seduction of the ice. In their glittering towns they lived and drank glühwein and worked their weaving. Some say that the presence of so many elves in one place, so much magic in one region, simply created an empty space in the universe that Santa Claus could fill like a key. Some say it was rank colonization by a piece of European folklore that broke off and floated away. Either way, a house appeared in the center of Tig Quirk Mully, hung with glittering icicles and sweet round doors, and eventually someone came to live in it and took on a mythologically lucrative profession, and a logical labor-sharing commune was established among all the Mully folk. Number 8. Santa Claus is concerned about the problem of Arctic ice. The ice is the spouse of the elves, and she is sick. She is the primary source of their magic, as the elves cannot be separated from the place where they live. For many years now, this is all they have asked for Christmas, that the ice should come back. Number 9. Once an elf queen by the name of Gifwas rode her royal seal out onto the ice and called down the moon. She lifted her arms above her head and her hair turned blue and the moon drifted down the sky like a white petal. She held it in her arms like a child, and somehow she was big enough or it was small enough. She asked the moon for a gift, and in her hands it turned into a pale silver present wrapped with a sprig of pine and a lavender bow. When she took it home and opened it in her innermost chambers, she found a glass wedding ring. Once a year, the moon turns into a very nice man with white hair and knocks on her door. Santa sometimes calls Gifwas Mrs. Claus, but everyone knows she is married to the moon, forever and for all time. Number 10. Santa Claus has only been seen 7 times in all of his long career. This is a very good record. Mainly he is seen because he wants to be. That or the reindeer give him away. The most recent sighting was in France. Little Marguerite Lisson was sleeping in the back room of a cafe where her friend worked the morning baking shift. She didn't see him because she deserved it more than other people. She didn't see him because she was special. She saw him because a reindeer was lonely. She didn't wake up when the man in red came into the house, but before midnight passed, she felt a soft velvet nose nuzzle her hand, and then more, lightly fuzzed antlers beneath her fingers. She smiled as she opened her eyes and saw a pair of eyes, deep and black, with stars in them. Number 11. Santa Claus actually met Jesus once when they were both very young. Santa wasn't even called Claus yet, and he didn't wear red. He was just thin and tired and alone, and so was Jesus. And they shared some wine and talked about what it was like to be folklorically dense nexus points. You can't really understand something like that without experiencing it. At the time, no one even believed in them yet. They were just knots of colliding memes, waiting for their destiny, the way kids do after high school but before college, sitting out on that bridge over the river, kicking their feet out into the air, wondering what they're going to be when they grow up. Number 12. Santa Claus doesn't really like cookies and is lactose intolerant. He doesn't mind, though. He knows that it is quite literally the thought that counts. Cookies are quantum clusters with a raspberry swirl and chocolate chips. They tell him who he is. They say, you are hot and sweet and alive, even in the cold. And in at least three other universes, you wear purple. Without cookies, he might lose his moorings, and on a journey like his, you cannot afford to take a wrong turn down some pulsar-strewn alley. Number 13. The Coca-Cola Company sometimes claims to have invented the modern version of Santa Claus. That's not true. What happened was that somewhere between the former terribly exciting coca leaf heavy recipe and the more staid classic Coke batches, a young cola chef put forward and produced several cases of an experimental soft drink that induced in the entire board of Coca-Cola a series of fever dreams in which they were chased by a certain red-cloaked figure through a dark wood, their blood shrieking in their limbs, terror clutching at their throats, the smell of holly and Christmas everywhere, and then, oh, the spear. Most of the board never quite recovered their wits, and the cola chef was summarily dismissed. And thereafter, the man in red begins to appear in Coca-Cola's wintertime advertisements. Number 14. As to how Santa Claus delivers all those presents in one night, it has seemed clear for some time that he possesses a localized wormhole small enough to pack into a reasonably sized steamer trunk and tidy enough not to smell too musty when taken out for the holidays. Number 15. It seems probable that the silver jingle bells comprise a renewable energy source for the wormhole, being as they are the remains of super-dense stars attached to his sleigh with red string. Number 16. Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny are not related, though of course they have had professional dealings, both of them being warriors, standing watch on either side of the winter. Santa feels it is rather cruel of the bunny to hide the eggs, and the bunny feels Santa makes the whole business rather too easy. It is a little-known fact that the summer solstice and autumn equinox also had champions. The summer horse brought dark red cherries and highly munchable tomatoes along with gifts of sunshine and unfrozen seas and little iron ponies mysteriously appearing on the mantle. The autumn maiden sat on a throne of pumpkins, and whatever vessel she touched filled with steaming cider or cocoa. Children buried wishes written on bits of paper in the cooling earth so that they could come up in the spring like tulips. Santa and the bunny are all that's left. Sometimes they miss their family, but they understand all too well the fragility of the consumer holiday cycle and how thin the ropes that tie it to myth, like a boat barely tied to the pier. Number 17. During the rest of the year, Santa Claus sleeps and studies advanced mathematics. Number 18. Santa Claus doesn't need a chimney. A house is a closed system, and at one time the chimney was the only reasonable approach. It was the only vampire-proof entrance to the domicile, the doors being guarded by the invitation addendum, and the chimney itself being far too filthy for the obsessive-compulsive vampire to bear. Santa Claus does not wish to be taken for a vampire. Vampires take, Santa Claus leaves. It's not the same thing at all. But it is impossible to specifically invite Santa Claus, only to tacitly do so by laying out of stockings, etc. Santa entered where he could. But these days, vigilance against vampires is extremely lax, and he can come through the front door without issue. Number 19. The list isn't about naughty and nice. If you think about it, coal is a very useful present. Santa Claus isn't a monster. You can burn that coal and stay warm in the winter. Just because it is black and grimy and it isn't a fantastical electronic intelligent machine with a kung fu grip and a pre-installed game suite, doesn't mean it's not beautiful and warm and formed over millennia in the heart of the earth, and very occasionally the difference between life and death. The list is about whether or not you need to figure out the lesson of the coal. Number 20. The stockings you hang up aren't the size of your own feet. That would be silly. You need those socks in the December nights. They are the size of Santa Claus's feet, which are wide and flat to help him get around the pole. Number 21. The reindeer are immortal. They are, in fact, the 8 demiurges of reindeer kind, and this accounts for their flying. Their name might sound whimsical, but they are the closest the human tongue can come to approximating the true names of the caribou lords. Rudolph, far from being the adorable, earnest fellow of the tale, is in fact Rudol Olafurid, the all-destroying flame of the Yukon. His mother was Kali, and his father was an ice floe. His nose appears red because his body is full of coals, and his eyes flare with the terrible conflagration of his soul. The tips of his antlers are like candles in the snowy wind. He is not vengeful, but he is the light in the dark of winter, consuming and giving life at the same time. Your carrots only make the Lord of Flame stronger. 22. Once there was a war in Santa Claus's kingdom. No one likes to speak of it. This was a very long time ago. It was not at Christmas time, but during the summer when all in Tigkir Mully is banked and waned and quiet. The Duke of the Orcas, Blig, wished not only to possess the wormhole and the steamer trunk that contained it, but also eat the Queen Gifwas's royal seal, who was named Gim, and had a fondness for Turkish delight. All were taken by surprise, and Blig's hunger was very great. All pitied him, save the seal. Gifwas called down her spouse the moon, and Blig ate it, such that when the moon rose back into the sky, it took the body of Blig with it. And not only was the moon made much more beautiful by its new orca coat, which you can see even now in the dark and light patterns on its surface, but Christmas, in a manner of speaking, was saved. Number 23. Santa Claus cannot see you when you are sleeping, nor can he see you when you are awake. He is not that kind of man, and is a little put off by the suggestion. He has his own affairs to tend to, thank you very much. Number 24. Santa Claus is a perfect integration of the id, the ego, and the superego. He is a perfect icon of integration. In his guise as this triple god, he simultaneously indulges all the most decadent desires of food and drink and wealth in a single morning of receiving, is driven across the whole of the world on the sleigh of purposeful dedication, and considers very seriously both the array of presents he will give and whether he will give them at all, the great judge of the self. Once, Freud asked for a cigar box for Christmas. Santa Claus did not read anything into it. Number 25. There is always the chance that Santa Claus will not come this year. It has never happened, but in the realm of probabilities, we must concede that there is that floating, strange variable. Without that chance, Santa Claus would not be what he is. Rather, he would be something dependable and every day, like the tide or the wind, and no one would think twice about him. It is this chance which makes children so excited on Christmas Eve. You simply cannot know. For this reason, it is vitally important, especially as one gets older, to ask for exactly what you want for Christmas, whether it be a unicorn that really talks, or an artificial intelligence that will not destroy the world, or a new job, or someone to love you despite your being a know-it-all, or a teddy bear, or universal health care, or the ability to finish things you start. Santa Claus does not judge wishes. He only wants you to be happy. He can't do everything. He is only a construct, not a constant. But he tries his very best to be good at his job. And every year, the sun grows a little stronger after he has passed through the world.
Once loved a sailor, once a sailor loved me, but he was not a sailor, who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing, and every evening at midnight he would come to my window and sing, come take a trip in my airship, come sail away to the stars. We'll travel to Venus, we'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're kissing, no one will know as we swoon. So come take a trip in my airship, and we'll visit the man in the moon. Sailing away from the crowds, we passed through the milky white way, while idly drifting, watching the clouds, he asked if I'd name the day. Just by the dipper I gave him my heart, the sun shone on our honeymoon. We swore to each other we never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my airship,
come sail away to the stars.
We'll travel to Venus,
we'll sail away to Mars.
No one will see while we're
Natalie Merchant, come take a trip on my airship, which, according to Rick Bose, and Rick was absolutely right, is a 1911 song written by some guy from Boston. It's the Boston aspect that I'm sure gets Rick going. This is Hour of the Wolf over listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And we're also video casting over Facebook Live. And I don't know if I said I'm Jim Freund, but I am, and still. And our guest this morning, in way too long a time, because she lives, like, off the continental U.S., off the east northeastern continental U.S., is Catherine M. Valenti. And that was wonderful.
I'm glad.
That was fab. And by the way, listeners, there's an idea of what I was trying to say. You can't encapsulate a Cat Valenti story. She doesn't fit into a genre. I take it back. There is a genre. The genre is called Cat Valenti. And that's really what it comes down to there is this, I don't know, just idyllic, dreamy feel I get for a lot of your fiction. Yeah, you shrug because you're the one person who's probably immune to it because
I'm not immune to it. I live in it longer than you guys do.
Well, yeah, but it's
faster for you to read a story and listen to it than it is for me to write it. I get to live in these places for much longer.
Yeah, but, you know, your imagination is like water to a goldfish, you know? It's like... I hope you can appreciate it as much as we do. Speaking of that, why don't you put on headphones and we will see what this person has to say for them, so pronoun trouble. How do you tag a phone caller before you put them on the air? Good morning, you're on the radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. Okay, well, try calling back. And by the way, if listeners wish to call on the air, the telephone number is, well, look on Kat's Twitter feed, but otherwise 347-335-0818. We also take comments over Facebook, where one person says, says, lovely reading, cookies are random clusters with raspberries and chocolate chips. Yeah, absolutely. Let's try this again. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
I'm sorry that The Sorcerer's Journey went bye-bye. One of my favorite pieces.
Okay, beside the point, let's talk to Kat and be relevant.
Kat, that story, incredible.
Oh, thank you so much.
Now, two things about it specifically. Thank you for mentioning he's a Canadian. And also, thank you for mentioning the Franklin Expedition, because as immediately as you said it, I could hear the late Stan Rogers singing Northwest Passage. Number two, the Rudolph comment.
Actually, that was... never mind. Go on.
No, the Rudolph comment.
I was going to say Spencer Tracy.
Is that really... No, I know the movie, James.
The
Rudolph comment. Is that real Yukon folklore?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It is out of my own mind.
Fantastic. Now, I want to say something specific about two of your books. The first time I read Orphan's Tales, and the second, and the third, I said to you...
Both volumes.
On the radio, both volumes. On the radio, and I also said when James had you on a Saturday morning...
Get to the point.
And that it was the finest example of the frame tale concept I've ever come across.
Thank you.
With one exception, a book that nobody's ever heard of called The Manuscript from Saragossa.
Which I have in my house, actually.
What?
Which, a book I own.
Oh, you own? Well, you and me and five others.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever heard of it. Great, great. Second, you wrote a book called Koshai.
It's called Deathless.
Deathless, yes. I think it is one of the finest retellings, unusual that it be, of a Russian or any other folk story I've ever come across.
Thank you so much. It's so kind of you.
Have you ever thought of doing that with another story?
I suppose in some ways you could say Deathless is the only full-length single fairy tale retelling that I've done, in that it doesn't bring in any other folk tales other than itself. And I would certainly love to do that again. In the beginning, when the Orphan's Tales had been so successful, I was worried about sort of being typecast as someone who only did fairy tales. So I did a lot of other stuff, but I have no doubt that I will return to.
Well, the idea of setting it in World War II with Stalin. And the interesting thing is that Stalin, being what he was a nationalist, and he had all the soldiers and all the commissars reading epic hero tales like Ilya of Murom and the Drusina stories and folk tales and everything else. And, of course, one of my favorite stories, and obviously it's reflected in Deathless, is the story of Marya Morevna, because she's a heroine.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
she's a fantastic female. Well, listen, good luck for your space opera. I can hardly wait.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Happy holiday.
You too.
Okay. I turned down my mic and leave his on. Okay, phone number here again at WBAI is 347-335-0818. And yeah, what he said. It's how, with all the writing that you do, how do you get to do all the reading and the research? And because of the amount of knowledge, world knowledge that you have amassed is vast.
I do have to say thank God for the internet, because I don't think I could write as fast if I was doing it the way we all had to before the internet was so ubiquitous. You know, I can find information. I can find out every single book that was on the shelf of the Bronte sisters in a few seconds because of the wonderful work of the Bronte Parsonage. I had a novel come out this fall called The Glasstown Game, which is about the Bronte siblings when they were children. So that kind of research can be done, even though it takes a long time, much more quickly than it used to be. I love to read and I love to research, and so much of my inspiration comes from reading nonfiction and narrative nonfiction and the academic kind of research that I used to do when I was a graduate student. I write very quickly, so if I can write a book quickly, it leaves more time for researching the next one and for reading for pleasure. When I need to know something, I take the time to learn it. That's just pretty much what it is. And when it's something that feels like it's beyond me to pick up from reading textbooks, then I go and talk to somebody who knows about it. And it's a really wonderful life where I just get to learn new things for a living and teach them to other people. It's pretty much the greatest.
And you live in an idyllic environment. How does that, I assume that helps your writing.
It's less idyllic during the winter when you have to shovel out the walk. But,
yeah,
you know.
yeah.
But yeah, Maine has always been a great inspiration to me, and the island that I live on is a very tight-knit community. Sometimes too tight-knit, sometimes just right.
Well, a tiny island. I watch webcams that are near where you live.
Yeah, it's very small.
Just to watch the puffins and seals.
Yeah. Well, we're not as remote as all that. We're only 2 miles off the coast of the biggest city in the state. Now, the biggest city in the state of Maine is...
Well, yeah.
I mean, you know.
No, this one is about 50 miles from where you live. The webcam that I watched is about 50 miles away.
Yeah.
Because I know both, so.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, there are more crocodiles in the state of Florida than people in the state of Maine. but we're not, it's not Matinicus Island, which is actually the easternmost island off
right.
the continental U.S. is 20 miles offshore. We're not as remote as all that, but the puffins do come down in the late winter. And it's a beautiful place.
It's where they winter over. It's the warm place for them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is all, well, we get seals here in New York. Mm. They do come down to the harbor if it isn't too polluted. And I actually can watch them from my house. But that's about as far as it goes. Max Schmidt says something. Okay, did I say to somebody, say something, and Max said something? I don't know. Again, listeners, you can be viewers if you go to Facebook Live and watch us. Or you can go to my page, Jim Freund, on Facebook. I'm always here, so I don't know. I'm always doing it live, so I don't know what it looks like. I think you just get a notification that Facebook Live events happen when they do, and that's where many people find us, hopefully so. And, of course, we're on 99.5 FM in New York and WBAI.org. What haven't you done that you would like to?
Oh, there's a few things that I sort of have in mind to do my usual branching out trick. I'd like to write a murder mystery.
Mm.
There's really probably no way I couldn't make it speculative in some sense, but I might like to write I've been tossing around the idea of a serial killer story set in the Restoration era.
Ooh,
you know, okay. Before forensic science was any good at this sort of thing, and when Samuel Pepys was spying on everybody. So I'm very interested in that mystery format, though that may be just because of some of the stuff that I'm working on right now. I'd like to write a straight...
Who beheaded Charles the First? No, yeah. Sorry.
I'd like to write a straight horror novel. I have a sort of I don't know, YA magical realism book called The Quidnuncs that I want to write, mm-hmm. Which is I've already written quite a bit of. Honestly, look what happened with space opera. I had no time in my schedule and no plans to write Eurovision in space, and someone made an offhand joke on Twitter, and here we all are. And honestly, I don't think I have ever had a book go from conception to finished manuscript as quickly as space opera did.
Wow.
It was round about a year, maybe a little bit less, 11 wow. months from had no notion of this book whatsoever to the book is done. Usually I sit and think a lot more with a concept. I live with it for a lot longer, and it was very fast. So I'm sure that...
And the lead time to publication isn't bad, right?
No, it's been a very quick process. We wanted to put it out in time for Eurovision next year. So it'll be out April 3rd.
Wow.
Yeah. So it has. It's been
a quick process. So from conception to publication.
Yeah, so it'll be... I guess it'll be...
Like two and a half years.
Two and a half years?
Yeah.
From conception to
publication. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's very short.
That's amazing.
Very short.
To do that without self-publishing.
Yeah. So I guess it'll be just about 2 years exactly.
Yeah.
So it's crazy quick. And that's fantastic. So, you know, who knows what my next thing will be. Maybe it will come from someone giving me a challenge on Twitter.
Oh, Max claims that Facebook asked him to say something. So he
okay.
said something, but he said it to us. Sigh.
But my next adult novel is a post-apocalyptic Western that has, people will recognize the civilization. I think it started out as one thing and the election happened and has become something much more political than it once was. But it remains a post-apocalyptic Western.
You have been vocal about
the
politics. I am merely in denial. I have on my browser, my Chrome browser, I have two extensions. One is that it takes the words Trump and replaces it with the words Voldemort, or He Who Must Not Be Named,
or Tom
M. Riddle. It mixes it up,
yeah.
And it makes the newspaper decent to read when you see Mr. Riddle said, and so forth. And the other one is called Make America Kittens Again. And every time there's a photograph of that personage, it turns it into a kitten.
That's a good extension.
And those are two great extensions. So I just live I don't live in the dystopia that we have fallen into.
I mean, we all do live in it. And I didn't talk about politics for a long time because I got a lot of pushback from people who said that I should stick to my fairy tales and not talk about it, and nobody wants to hear what an author really thinks. But with the election last year, it seemed to me that staying silent was to be complicit, and I couldn't just let things happen anymore. And maybe not even complicity, but it's a luxury to stay silent, to not speak to what's happening around you. And I didn't want that luxury anymore, and I didn't take it. And now I talk all the time, and I'm quite sure that I annoy people. And that's fine. I'm comfortable with
that.
This
is a good thing.
But people still tell me to go back to my fairy tales. So after the election, I wrote a short prequel story to Fairyland called The Beasts Who Fought for Fairyland. And Beasts Who Fought for Fairyland all the way to the end. And it is a way to explain the election to your kids. It is a way of understanding that all these stories where we defeat the Dark Lord in the end are only those kinds of stories because we come into them at the end.
Yeah.
And it always sucks to not be at the end of a story. And we're at the Empire Strikes Back part right now where it just looks bad. But, you know, the fact is we're probably not at the Empire Strikes Back part. It just seems that way. It's probably going to get worse before it gets better. But the only way it gets better is by taking our own agency and taking the opportunity to speak and taking the opportunity to vote and no longer taking that luxury.
And not staying silent.
And not staying silent.
Which is, Blessed Time Magazine.
I am trying to thread the line of remaining a children's author and an adult author and someone who doesn't stay silent.
Yeah. 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 It's a necessity for all of my desire to escape, for all of my unwillingness, and yet I am the child of two Holocaust survivors, two German Jews. Yeah. So, but I guess a certain reaction sometimes is to stay silent. Some people assimilate and all that. Other people simply have outrage. Yeah. And it's very, very difficult in this day
and
age.
But it's okay to be outraged. Outrage is fine. It's okay to be outraged. Like there are reasons to be outraged. It's been hundreds of years of garbage. Like it's okay to be outraged. You just have to do something constructive rather than destructive with that outrage.
Yeah.
And many people are trying to do that, and many people are misunderstood when they try to do that. We are all just trying our best to get through this world, and I think that people would do better to realize that everyone else is just trying their best as well. I don't know. It's all a mess. Believe it or not, in all the comedy and weird aliens, this is one of the themes of space opera. I think you'll find it's going to be one of the themes of most books that people write for a while, because you can't get it out of your head. Every morning you check your phone and some new thing you didn't even know was allowed to happen is happening. They've outraced the conspiracy theorists. Like, the actual conspiracies that are happening are weirder than the ones that people got called crazy for 20 years ago. And it's all a very strange new world. You know, I think we were prepared for a science fiction dystopia, but not for a magical realist one, which is what we're living in.
Yeah, yeah. Although to me, I don't know. I just don't have the words for it because it's insanity. And what's more insane are the people who remain complicit. It's a wonderful thing that people are finally speaking out. It's taking some people who I admired and are wonderful, in my head were wonderful also. This is a different end. Yeah, I wonder if there isn't the Me Too movement may be to an extent a fallout of living in a dystopia. It's like, okay, we've had enough. So things are finally boiling over to where some people could become brave and speak their mind. I don't know. Maybe. Talking nonsense. probably, but it just, you know, I don't know how to cope.
Oh, I don't think anyone really does. I don't think anyone really does.
And that's why I think the literature that I read, that you write, is so essential.
Look, I know that most of us artists had a really hard time after November of last year of asking ourselves what is the function of what we do in this very unbrave new world. Mm-hmm. Not that new. It's really just the old world coming back. The old world we were trying to escape. It's not new at all. Robber barons are as old as time. And I think that many of us just still continue to struggle with it. Like, we were writing these, our fairy stories and our future stories and our ghost stories, and does that really help anyone? Is that what we should be devoting our lives to? But I hope that what I create matters on some level still, that it can help on some level still, that it can speak truth to power, as cliche as that may be. Sorry, Ray. That is the function of art, and that it is still something that can be done. You know, part of the reason that I wrote Deathless is that there's a wonderful tradition in Russian literature of using science fiction and fantasy as a safe place to criticize the government.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that it will be for us as well.
Yeah, The Strugatsky brothers, for those who don't know, were excellent, excellent at disguising their dissent, their commentary on Soviet issues and affairs within their science fiction. The best is Stanislaw Lem, who's Polish, but still was under the Soviet heel in so many ways when he was writing. And I met this wonderful person who came to your event last night, who in English calls herself Regina. She represents a huge corporation in China that is bringing science fiction to other media in China and also to the U.S. And she's been working with Clark's World magazine and just bringing, making people more aware of Chinese authors. And I wonder, it's not that easy unless you are a Chinese American, like, say, Ken Liu or Charles Yu or some of these people, to write dissension in your literature. I don't think it's quite as simple.
Well, I mean, the three-body problem opens with very moving critique of the Cultural Revolution. And
I
can in no way speak about the difficulties of writing in China because I am not Chinese nor writing in China, so I can't
But thinking about the politics of imaginative literature, speculative fiction, in politics, in the world in which you live, to be able to better express oneself when one can't, because in the dystopia that we're in, if this goes on, as Heinlein would say, we are going to be in a doomed 1984, or already in 1984, in the novel, that is. We've already got the double speak and so forth. Sad, as somebody who double speaks might say on Twitter. But yeah, I agree with you. It's going to get better before. It's going to get worse before it gets better, but I think it's going to get better.
I hope so.
I think it has to.
I hope so. I mean, yeah, that's all you can say is that you hope so, and then you can fight as hard as you can for it. You know, I happen to live in Maine, where one of the few senators that can be swayed lives, although after her vote on the tax bill, I'm not sure I really believe in that statement anymore.
Well, you knew she was Republican.
Well, of course, yes, but you have to understand.
On the other hand, what she did some brave things this year.
She did, and you have to understand that a Maine Republican isn't always, I mean, we also
might be a real Republican as opposed to.
My point was that I have her on speed dial, and I have never in my life before this year called my senator for anything, and I've called Susan Collins' office a lot.
Yeah.
I think I'm having a long-term relationship with her voicemail. and maybe that helps and maybe it doesn't.
I was going to ask. Yeah, sometimes it just feels better. Yeah, I have a rep.
And that's how they came to power, is by having people turn out to vote, turn out to write letters, turn out to call into radio shows. You know, like, it does work. We just haven't been doing the work.
Yeah.
It's hard to admit that. I mean, I admit I didn't vote in the midterms. That, like, it's hard to look at yourself and your own failure to participate. It's hard to do that self-examination, but we have to on the left. We have to acknowledge that we've not been doing as well as they have getting ourselves represented.
Exactly, because, you know, it doesn't always work. It's lovely that you can win the real vote, the popular vote, but then you didn't deal properly with the electoral vote, and that's all that mattered. And so if even more people had been involved in the popular vote, then the electoral would not have been an issue.
Yeah.
And good morning, WBAI, you're on the radio.
Oh, yes. I want to say I thank you so much for this program. I love this person speaking, but I didn't get her name.
My name is Catherine.
She said that people should be calling in for radio shows. I wanted to call in right away.
Yeah. You don't have to use the third-person pronoun. You're talking to Kat Valenti. Yeah.
Could you spell that?
Sure. My name is Catherine Valenti. It's spelled CatherYnne. V as in Victor, Alente.
And that ends in an E for Edward?
Yes.
And you said Catherine with a Y.
Yes.
Right?
It's an unusual spelling.
It is an unusual spelling.
It's K-A?
No,
C-A. But to be perfectly honest, if you put any spelling of Catherine with that surname into Google, you will find me.
Wow. I just...
And you can get her books.
I'm so inspired by what you're saying. And you wrote actually a fairy tale that ends... in other words, that says that, well, we find out about everything at the end and then we have to fight then. What was the name of that fairy tale?
It's called The Beast Who Fought for Fairyland All the Way Till the End.
The Beast?
The Beasts Who Fought for Fairyland.
Pull the mic a little closer to you.
The Beasts Who Fought for Fairyland All the Way Till the End.
Just a minute, for Fairyland. Now, I'd like you on my radio show, too, because I do a show at WUSB.
Plus USB.
WUSB.
Yep.
A
great station.
A woman's perspective on politics on Mondays 1:30 to 3.
I would love to.
What is your name?
It's Zabby.
Zabby.
Z-A-Z-A-B-B-Y. And you can Google Zabby and you'll WUSB and you'll find me there.
Well, Zabby, if you email me, jim@ourwolf.com, I will forward that to Kat and hook you up, and I will say that Stony Brook Radio, WUSB, is wonderful. I'm waiting for one of your colleagues to walk in the door now, Lister, because he follows me, and he's on USB as well.
Yes, I know Lister.
Yeah, who doesn't?
I always like listening to his guest that he comes in with at the end of the program.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's amazing. Somebody has... And the story, by the way, that you were asking about is available at Catherine Valenti, CatherineValente.com/ The Beasts Who Fought for Fairyland. And there's hyphens... Are there hyphens, Heath? Yes. There are hyphens in between each of those words. The Beasts Who Fought for Fairyland. I think
Google my name and Beasts and Fairyland, you'll find it. I put it after the election. It was therapeutic for me as well, but I also just wanted to have something I could post every time someone said, go back to Fairyland. And I could say, absolutely, I will. and link them to it. And I put it up on my website for free. It is free to reproduce in any fashion forever.
You made it public domain?
I did. I have never and will never take any payment for it.
Yeah, but you should do Creative Commons.
It is a Creative Commons license.
Oh, okay, yeah. So it's not public domain.
And you are absolutely, anyone is absolutely free to reproduce and distribute it in any way they please, as long as I have credit for it. I don't particularly care. I just want, if people need that story, if it can help them to heal and to go forward, I want them to have it without any barriers.
That's right, because I've been saying for the last year, talking about the arts, using the arts to, in fact, raise consciousness. And like you say, we're living in a braveless new world.
Mm.
And it's a very sad situation.
It is.
Very sad. And so, like you said, I'm sort of in that realistic camp there that we're finding things out every minute, and they've already happened before we can do anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so easy to feel helpless. I mean, there are many more of us than there are of people in government, but it's very easy to feel unspoken for on the left. And that's what they want.
Indeed.
That's what they want.
It is time for us to
Could I ask you, Jim, could you keep me on the line so that I could get Catherine's phone number after the show finishes?
No, because we have to leave, and Habte Selassie, instead of Lister, is already here to come in, and I'm already 2 minutes over. What you can do is email me. Jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or write me on Facebook, and I will connect you.
And I am very easy to find online, Zabby. If you go to Twitter, I am Kat Valenti on Twitter.
That's the best way to reach her.
That's the best way. CATVALENTE. I am Catherine Valenti on Facebook. Kat Valenti on Patreon. My name goes to me, so you will be able to find me very easily.
And a unique writer.
And anyone else can as well who is listening through any of those services. I am very easy to get a hold of, and I do that on purpose. Okay. After the election, I actually opened up my direct messages to anybody who needed someone to talk to. So you can find me very easily.
Thank you, Zabby.
And thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim. It reminds me of when you did that other program, too, on going to Venus. Remember that science fiction that you did where people were leaving and they bought into leaving?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, yes, absolutely.
That was a wonderful program, too, that you did with Max.
Yes, yes.
In conjunction with him.
It was a lot of fun. And we'll be doing more. Been doing this show now we're in our 46th year. So, actually, as of next month, 47th year. So, hopefully, we'll keep on going. But we're out of time for today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Zabby. I'll be looking for you on WUSB.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Kat, it has been way too bleeping long. And, you know, we could possibly, well, you get weird connections, but we could try Skyping.
Yeah. I get very good connections on the island.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're not as remote as all that.
Yeah. Okay. So, listen, we are so out of time this morning. Because I didn't know you were here, Hobte.
Yes, I is.
Yes, you. Yes, he is. So I am starting my outro music. I'm going to make way. Stay tuned for Burn, Baby, Burn with Hobte Selassie filling in for Lister. Coming your way in as soon as I get out of this seat. Thank you, Kat Valenti, for being here. Thank you all for listening. People, be good to each other. We deserve it. You deserve it. Good morning.
99.5 FM, WBAI, New York, and Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund will be back next week. And when does he come on? At midnight? I'm not sure, but he'll be back next week. And it is 3 minutes after 3 o'clock. And we would just like to welcome you to Burn Baby Burn for today. What is it? It is Thursday, December 7th, 2017. It's kind of hard to do it from your head. I'm accustomed to having it written down. But nonetheless, my name is Haptah Selassie, and I'm sitting in for Lister. Lister will be back next week, and I just want to thank him for giving me this opportunity, and thank you for listening. And I think maybe the best way to begin this morning is like this.
us too close.